Welcome to this week's episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks. On this week's episode, the guys talk all about the Florida housing market. Is there going to be a crash, or is the news just trying to scare you again? All while sipping and reviewing Three Chords Strange Collaboration, a bourbon finished in Pinot Noir barrels.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks, powered by Living in Colorado, The Mile High Perspective on YouTube, Fathom Realty, and Keller Williams Downtown. My name is Charlie Sardelli, and as always, I'm here with
Jameson Amoros.
And on this week's episode, Oscar will not be joining us. He's got some work going on. He's got some showing. So Oscar Barr is always the third one on our show today, but Jameson and I are going to take it today. And on this podcast, not only do we talk about real estate, but we drink, enjoy, and review bourbon.
We do.
And this week's bourbon is no different than some of the ones that we've had in the past where strike a chord, where the Rouge, our wonderful sponsor here in Greenwood Village, they have provided us with another barrel select. This time it is from the company named Three Chord, and this is a single barrel cask strength select. And what's actually cool about this bottle is that it's finished in Pinot Noir bottles.
We got a little bit of something for everybody.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
this used to be a wine bar. Mm-hmm. Then it turned to a wine and bourbon bistro.
Thank you, Chris.
So I feel like this is an embodiment of the culmination of the transformation.
Especially
of
the color.
Roots. Right.
On this thing is gorgeous. Well, if you guys aren't watching the video or listening to the audio, another cool thing that came along with this bottle, and it's actually sitting in the middle of the set right now, is this guitar. And what's really cool about Three Chords is Three Chords was founded by just a bunch of musicians that love bourbon. And if you're on the video version, you could see it right here. This guitar was actually signed by one of the founders of Three Chord. And his name is Neil Giraldo. If you know that name, if you're into music, then it'll stand out to you. So Neil actually signed this guitar, and Chris let us know that in the future they will be giving away this guitar.
Oh, that's
they're going to do a raffle. They're going to do something to give this guitar away, so you get that signed. And if you guys don't know, Neil is a professional musician. This is straight from their website. Professional musician, producer, and film composer with over 4 decades of experience. Chris told us that he wrote for Pat Benatar, mm-hmm. John Waite, Kenny Loggins, Steve Forbay, the Dell Lords, and Beth Hart, as well as Rick Derringer. So just a lot of musical energy in this bourbon.
I mean, he has credit for over 45 million records sold.
That's wild.
That's fact number one. Fun fact number two, he was the first guitarist to appear on MTV.
Really?
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Pretty dope, right? Like, yeah. I mean, yeah.
For all you kids at home, MTV used to actually be music television.
Yeah, it wasn't just Jersey Shore.
Other things like
that. Or The Challenge. It used to actually be late night music.
Yeah, late night music. Every Saturday you could wake up, get a good rundown of the most recent hip-hop.
Dude, TRL? Yep. TRL was great, mm-hmm. right? TRL was awesome. Yeah.
Loved it.
Well, I were just talking about how you know you're a millennial, mm-hmm. and you have to sign in.
To a website.
And like to a website and ask you like what date that you were born in. Mm-hmm. And I told Charlie it's like the Wheel of Fortune because I was born in 85. It obviously starts in 2025. So I have to go and just wait. And usually when it stops, then I'm right around like 81, 82. Mm-hmm. I get to scroll up a couple of 85. So, yeah, it's depressing.
I still get my heart still drops a little bit. Because let's be honest, guys. I'm a younger millennial, and I was.
We're on the tail end. You're a younger one. I'm an older millennial. Yeah.
Elder millennial.
An elder millennial.
I was like, I remember like going on to a first couple sites that you're not supposed to go on when you're younger.
Yeah.
And you get that message that pops up. You're like, ooh.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be
and
here.
And now you're like, God damn it! I wish I wasn't supposed to be here.
I wish I was supposed to be here. Exactly. Yeah. As my lower back hurts when I get a new mattress.
Yep.
Exactly. Another cool fact about Three Chord here. This barrel pick specifically is from their Strange Collaboration. And the reason it's called the Strange Collaboration is because they actually partnered with a winery.
Or a vineyard.
A vineyard in New York. It's called Strange Winery or Strange Vineyards. And this bourbon itself, standard for Three Chord, is aged between 3 to 6 years. And then after, it's finished in Pinot Noir casks and bottled at 99 proof. Okay, I just want to point that out. It's bottled at 99 proof.
Yes, it is.
The bottle we currently have right now that we're going to be drinking today is sitting at 112 proof, 56.4%. So Chris did it to us again. He gave us another heavy hitter. But the mash bill for this is 75% corn, 21% rye, and 4% malted barley.
So it should be on the sweeter side.
It should, especially with that Pinot Noir. I'm going to go ahead and pour it out real fast. Ooh, love that pop. The smell on it is immediately sweet. And again, guys, this is a barrel pick from the Rouge and Pinotry here. So you can only get this this bottle, this flavor of the bottle here. It's going to be completely different than any other one that you're going
to
buy off the shelf.
I want to make sure we get the right information. It's not a New York vineyard. It's a California vineyard.
Okay. Okay.
So it's the Strange Family Vineyards in Santa Rita Hills, California.
God, where did I get New York from?
I don't know.
Are they from, is Three Courts from New York?
I thought I said New York's Kentucky.
Yeah, because Kentucky straight bourbon.
It's perfectly tuned in Michigan, so they distill it. I mean, you're still on the wrong side of the country, but
whatever.
That's fine. It's okay.
I'm a New Yorker. Everything's New York over here. All right.
So, goddamn Italians.
Just the nose on it, 100% sweet. I mean, just the color of this thing.
Yeah, it is a deep amber.
Yeah, and what's funny is you would think that it was going to be a little bit lighter because of the Pinot, but it looks like it adds more of a dark.
Oh, dude, that is...
Yeah.
Wow.
It's getting it on the nose. I mean, the sweetness comes through, the caramel.
Plums.
Yeah, the berry.
Berry, plum, caramel.
Oh, man.
Hint of vanilla.
This is dangerous. Not 112 proof. Maybe we just got to the point now where we're drinking way too many above 100 proofs that it's not burning, but...
I know, I do want to... That's what one reason I like having some guests on the show that aren't necessarily bourbon drinkers is we'll have a bourbon like this, and like when we taste it, we're just... Man, and we're appreciating the flavor profile and everything.
Yep.
And if you look over, if you guys are watching the video, you zoom in on the person that's not used to drinking 112 proof, even with this, which we consider very sweet, their face is just like trying to, like they feel like they have to enjoy it because they're on the podcast.
Yep.
And you can see the internal battle raging, like, I can't, I gotta suck it up. I gotta do it.
I gotta get through this.
I gotta get through it.
Yep, 100%. 100%. Well, I mean, what I love the most about it, too, is
there's
that sweetness
that,
there.
The tannins of the wine, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, if you guys drink wine, there's a very specific note, and it's because of the acidity when it ferments, and you get this on the nose. I mean, if I 100%. Closed my eyes and somebody just put this under my nose, I would immediately think that it was a type of wine.
Yep. Well, and, you know,
until that caramel hits.
Yes. Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. Is what's wild about this one is you actually get that oak. Like the barrel comes through fully in the nose, which you don't really get a lot. All right. Well, cheers. I'm going to go ahead and get this sip in. All right. Here we go. 112.
Whew. All right.
That's dangerous. Wow. Oh, man.
Bruh.
This is like an opposite of what these kind of barrels usually are. It's it's sweet up front, but then it kind of, and you get the caramel, you get the vanilla, then it kind of goes to the earthiness of the oak. Then you get the plum sweetness in the wine with the dryness on the back of the palate. That's wild.
That the flavor though sitting on the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
After you take the sip, is different. It's very caramel, vanilla.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Toasted, almost like a toasted barrel.
Almost like that sweetness like a toasted
like
barrel,
like a toasted marshmallow almost. Burn's there.
Yeah.
Which is crazy because the burn is not on the nose.
No.
Like it does not normally when we're drinking 112 proof bourbon. That burn, that ethanol, you can taste it.
Yeah.
I guess smell it in the nostrils, but it's just, I think there's so many flavors, it covers it up. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you take a sip, that burn's there.
Yeah.
That initial burn's there.
But it's a good burn. It's not like that overpowering, like you get a bad 112 proof and it's just, all it is ethanol. I want to categorize this as a dessert. Like, I'm interested to see how this opens, but... It's very much like a after dinner for me right now. It's very much like an after dinner relaxation out by the fire.
Correct.
Kind of bourbon. And it's odd because I wouldn't expect a Pinot to do that. I expect more bite.
A Pinot is going to be drier.
Yeah, right? That's what I mean. Yeah.
So I think that helps because when you've got a bourbon that's a high corn mash bill, you're going to get a very sweet finish.
Mm-hmm. And it is 4%. malted. Right. So
right, but then it's 21% rye. Mm-hmm. So I think when you have that dryness of the Pinot, I think it helps balance that sweetness out. Because to me, I'd love to taste this exact thing without it being aged in a Pinot barrel. I think it would be almost too sweet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For 112 proof. Well, and that's like, what I mean is the dryness is like sitting back here.
Right.
And that's why I like, because normally you get the dry up front when you get wine barrels. Yes. It sucks almost all of that moisture out. But this one, it's just sweet up front.
Yeah.
Oaky, kind of vanilla in the middle.
It's got a good balance. It's got a very good balance.
I'm digging it so far. That's
so
awesome.
The notes, just so you know, like where it's supposed to be from a taste standpoint, sweet with light caramel, vanilla character, hints of clove, and black fruit.
The black fruit is definitely overpowering the clove.
Yes.
I think the clove might be what's on the center of the palate.
Correct.
That's kind of mixed in with the wood.
Yeah, but it evaporates pretty quick.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the finish, silky mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Oh, it gets better. Subtle Pinot Noir notes, which absolutely.
Yep.
And a mild hug.
A mild just hug. We could all use a hug.
Probably like a one arm.
Yeah.
Hug. Not a full bear hug. Yeah, not a full bear.
No, this is 112 like proof hug. Like,
hey,
what's
buddy,
up, bro?
Listen, I know it's been a rough
life's all right.
But you know what?
It's going to be better.
You ever hear that? You listen to rap.
Yeah.
Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a song with Lil Yachty.
Yep.
And it starts out. He goes, man, these kids.
These kids.
Look around. Look at life.
Look at life.
That's a mild hug. Man, it's a Lil Yachty hug.
Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot. All right. So as we sip and review this, one thing that I do want to bring up, and we talk about this all the time, one reason why we love the Rouge is not only because of the selection that they have, but because they always push people to try new whiskeys, new bourbons, new spirits. And what's amazing this month is they are actually doing an Irish flight. So
starting in March.
It's starting now, but it's going to go into March. They're doing an Irish flight, and they have
Yellow Spot?
Yellow Spot, Green Spot.
Red Spot.
And Gold Spot. So three of them.
So yellow, green, and gold?
Yellow, green, and gold, yep. And basically it's going to be, I think she said, anywhere between $55 to $58 for a flight, but they're all 2-ounce pours. And if you know Irish whiskey, you'll know yellow spot, green spot, and gold spot. Gold spot is pretty hard to find from what I hear. So just between those three 2-ounce pours at $55 to $58 for the flight, it's a great opportunity for you to try Irish whiskeys. And if you don't really know the difference between an Irish whiskey, Canadian whiskey, American whiskey, Irish whiskey is most of the time triple distilled. So what ends up happening is it's going to lean a little bit lighter on the proofing and some of that complexity on the flavor because it is getting distilled a little bit more, but it's a lot easier of a drinker.
Well, and the way they do Irish whiskey for the most part, especially with Gold Spot, Green Spot, Red Spot, all those, is the difference is they're pot distilled.
Mm-hmm.
So similar to a Scotch.
Yep.
But it doesn't have that Scotch earthy tone because it's triple distilled after the fact. So you still maintain some of that kind of earthy flavor and taste.
Yep.
But it's triple distilled, so it's a lot smoother. So if you're a person that likes bourbon, has been curious about going into that Scotch single malt type world, Irish whiskey, Gold Spot, Yellow Spot, Green Spot is a really good balance between the two. So
I like it.
And Gold Spot, I want to say the 13-year age is like $250 in the second market.
Wow.
$50, something like that.
That's awesome.
To have a $250 bottle with a 2-ounce pour, along with the other ones for $55 is
not
amazing.
Bad at all.
No.
Not bad at all.
Nope.
And like we say, guys, we don't just drink bourbon whiskey on the podcast. We also talk about real estate, and the whole point and the reason that we do that is because we want to arm you with information on the market, what's going on, just so you can have a little bit better understanding. Cause at the end of the day, you don't do this all day, every day, all day, like we do. And it's a lot harder to understand and distill the information coming from the news articles. So talking about the news articles, one topic that we want to talk about today, and you guys hear us talk about this all the time, how hyper-specific and hyper-local real estate can be. And one place that's been in the news for the last week is the Florida housing market. And the Florida housing market is experiencing some of what I would say is the most market-specific changes right now.
Yes. And the rubber band has snapped back.
Yes.
Or is in the process of snapping back.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that in a couple of places, right?
Yeah.
Florida, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen it in Seattle.
Yep.
Austin, Texas. Those are the three big ones that we've seen that had this incredible run-up in home values and home prices during and post-COVID.
Yep.
And they've now snapped back to reality. Denver's seen it a little bit.
Yes.
But the reason, and I think this is an interesting topic, because when you do read the headlines, right, as always, they're clickbaity, right? And this one specifically uses the term cataclysmic decline in the Florida 2025 housing market.
Jesus.
Which is hilarious because we read an article, I read one about a week ago about Colorado, saying that home prices, if they decline 10%, it weren't a housing crash, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the argument is, sure, let's say they do decline 10%. But if you take where they were at since 2020, we're up 45%.
Mm-hmm.
So if you decline 10 over the course of that 7 to 8 years, we're still up 35%.
Well, and that's the, you know? I think the important thing to remember here too is, like Jameson said, is if you're looking at the headlines, it's all talking about, is Florida's housing market getting ready to crash? Are we about to see a crash in the Florida housing market? And it's what they're basing that on, just flat out, is home prices.
Yes.
And that is just one element of a housing market, right? And one of the articles that I read was saying that Florida housing, it has decreased anywhere between 3% to 5% in price. But if you actually zoom in and you look at the single family residences, they've actually increased by 2%. So that's where one thing that we want to talk about is some of the factors that are going into this and why people are talking about it like this. Because we've talked about this again, home insurance is playing a huge role in the housing market.
Yes.
I would say more now than almost ever before.
I agree. Yeah,
right?
I agree.
And so I guess what I want to kind of talk about with the hyper-local and hyper-specific and some of the factors that we're seeing is, one thing that is leading to this housing scare in Florida is insurance companies. We had Mason on. He explained kind of the back end of insurance and how that works, how they price things out. But you guys have seen it. Insurance companies are pulling out of areas like Florida, which if you have a mortgage, you have to have home insurance.
I mean, you don't have to, but then you got to self-insure.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right?
And it's smarter to have home insurance if you have a mortgage. 100%.
Yeah. I mean, so we talk about factors that drive housing prices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the big ones are supply versus demand, right? And then cost or affordability.
Yep.
And like Charlie said, affordability right now, yes, home prices and interest rates are having an effect, but more importantly in specific areas like Florida, home insurance.
Mm-hmm.
For example, over the last 2 years, home insurance premiums in Florida alone in most counties have gone up 60 to 80%, right? So if you think about that, put it into a numbers term, if you're, and this is not like exact, but I'm just going to use round numbers because it's easier. If your, you know, let's say your 6 month home insurance premium was $1,000 every 6 months, right? Which in Florida, it's way more than that, but for numbers sake, an 80% increase means that went from $1,000 to $1,800. So if you break that down, $800 over 6 months, you're talking over $120 a month, right? So $120 a month on top of what is supposed to be a steady mortgage payment, that's a big jump.
Absolutely.
Right? And we're talking, that's a $1,000 premium. For the most part, you're talking $5,000-$6,000, right? So 80% of that, I mean, that's a $4,500
increase,
wild. Dude. Like,
it's
wild. We're talking $600-$700 a month in insurance premium increases.
Mm-hmm.
And that is driving up the cost of not only buying the house, but people that already own it are going, wait a second. And if you think about it this way, right, who moves to Florida for the most part? What's it known as?
It's snowbirds.
Snowbirds, right? And for the most part, snowbirds have what? Fixed
money.
Incomes. Well, right, but they have fixed incomes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they're living off of a retirement fund.
Mm-hmm.
So if they bought a home 6 years ago to retire in Florida, and now all of a sudden their mortgage payment just went up $800 a month, but their income hasn't changed because they are on a fixed income for the most part, right? Now all of a sudden you're going, well, I can't live here. I can't afford to live here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're putting their homes on the market.
Yes, and that's exactly, I'm glad you ended on the putting their homes on the market, because one factor that is leading to this scare, and Jameson touched on it a couple minutes ago or seconds ago, was supply and demand. You guys hear us talking about it all the time. It is the most basic, low-level indicator of any economic state, supply and demand, right? And the thing that is kind of throwing all of these people into a fit over Florida's housing market is you're seeing some places that normally only have 1,300 homes on the market that are now up to 4,800, or some areas that used to have 13,000 and now are up at 20,000. Mm-hmm. And yes, if you were to go back and you look at what pretty much every analyst uses as the baseline for a market crash now, 2008, it's reminiscent of, oh shit, more houses are on the market right now, and the prices haven't really increased very much. Normally, that indicator would say, oh, home prices are going to plummet because there's way too much inventory, not enough demand.
Right.
And which is the opposite of what we're seeing in the overall mm-hmm. United States ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, again, this is why you have to have the full picture.
Yes.
Because if you just look at the amount of listings, yes, you're going to be like, oh my God, people are trying to get out, they're selling. And if you have more homes on the market and less buyers in the pool, that means that buyers have more power. Right? Because they can now go, oh, well, I can put an offer in on your house, but the house three houses down is the exact same floor plan, exact same square footage, everything, but they're lower. So I'm going to go with them because it's an easier price. That is how you start to see the decline in home prices. Mm-hmm. It's so much inventory that now it's a buyer's market. Mm-hmm. I don't see home prices going down at the rate that they did in 2008. I just don't see them declining as of right now with the statistics that we have from 2023, 2024 leading into now. Yes, the inventory is higher, but we're still sitting at home prices at 1 and 2% increase.
Yeah. I think hyperlocal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an article that came out from gobankingrates.com. Anyway, they were taking a look at Florida specifically, and mm-hmm. they went through 10 different counties that they felt were going to have the biggest fluctuation in home values towards the negative side, right? And when I say hyperlocal, here's a perfect example why. So Ocala, Florida, which is in Marion County, 3 years ago, we're in 2025, so it's 2022, coming out of the pandemic, interest rates were still low enough to where people were buying and selling, right? They had 800 homes listed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, 3,000,
mm-hmm.
right? So that is almost 60% over the inventory of what they had pre-pandemic.
Does it say what the inventory is? What kind of inventory?
So is mainly single family.
Single family homes.
This is mainly single family homes. So almost 50% over more, or sorry, 50% more inventory than they did pre-COVID, mm-hmm. right? And I think there's a couple of things that are at play here where there may be some counties specifically that are going to see a massive decline because yeah. all of Florida has seen the rise in insurance premiums. Mm-hmm. Okay. So yes, it's a buyer's market. So let's say that I'm looking at a home and I've got approved for a certain amount, right? That wasn't me. A certain amount. And because buyers can't afford it with the new insurance premiums, they're going to want a 20% reduction on price.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's say it's a $500,000 home. 20% would be $100,000, mm-hmm. right? So it goes down to a $400,000 home. So if you look at from a mortgage standpoint, for every $1,000, it's $6. That's what? $100,000. So six times 100, that's $600.
I don't know if you guys just heard the calculator clicking in Jameson's
yeah.
head
so,
right there.
So let's that's say, all that's yeah. so let's say the difference between a $400,000 home and a $500,000 home is a $600 a month difference
mm-hmm.
in your monthly payment. That's just your mortgage, right? But at the same time, if you can get a home for 20% less, so you're saving $600 on your mortgage, your mm-hmm. you know principal and interest, but your insurance is $600 more, you're essentially buying that same house
yep.
at $400,000 that you would for $500,000 overall cost. And that is keeping buyers on the sideline.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that if you've got 3,000 listings versus 800, but the buyers are not coming to the pool because even at a 20% discount, the pricing is the same. For like the actual monthly pricing mm-hmm. is the same when you take in account everything, but there's an extra 2,200 homes on the market. In certain areas, I do see that there's a potential that you're seeing a 30 to 40% drop because at the end of the day, it has to make sense for the people buying the house.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? And if there's no difference, mm-hmm. they'll go look at another county.
Yep. Well, and to that point too, is we're also seeing a lot of land has been purchased in Florida by developers
mm-hmm.
that it's not being developed
correct
currently
yes.
and that right there is an indicator of how much inventory is available
yep
because we talk about this all the time if your inventory is low, the developers are going to go in because there's an opportunity for them to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And they can then build, flip the house, sell it. Awesome. But if there's inventory that they can't compete with new builds, then they'll just sit on the land.
Yep.
And that's what we're seeing in a lot of the areas in Central Florida right now.
Lakeland.
Yeah.
So Lakeland's another one. That's Polk County. And yep. Lakeland's interesting because it's center of Florida. Like mm-hmm. it's just outside of Orlando, right? So from a hurricane standpoint, you're not getting those impacts. Mm-hmm. Builders in 2022, when we talk about inventory, pulled 200,000 permits to build. 200,000 permits to build new properties. And already the home values between last year and this year have gone down 2%. But we've had people, ReVenture is one of the biggest kind of analytical mm-hmm. or statistical companies out there.
Yep.
They're saying that it is one of the biggest walls of inventory that they have seen in any large U.S. county across the nation. So is that going to have a much different effect on that 2%? Will it accelerate? Probably.
You know, I'd love to reach out to somebody right now that's looking in Florida, that's looking to relocate to Florida, because, I mean, even people from, we often think Northeast, we often think, you know,
yeah.
New Jersey,
yeah, yeah.
New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, all that are moving the snowbirds, but people from Colorado are also moving, and the difference is there's a lot of equity here.
Correct.
So for somebody moving, I would love to have that conversation. It's like, hey, what are you feeling right now? How are you feeling that mm-hmm. you have the ability to go out there, and are you looking to buy long-term? Like, do you care
yep.
that home prices are going down? Are you okay with that? Or are you more timid right now
yep.
because you don't want to buy? And then with the way the direction's going in the market, you're going to lose value almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to see, you know, like, what's the mindset like right now? Because investor-wise, right, you always hear about Warren Buffett, buy when stocks are down, right? Buy when it's bad, because when it gets good, it's fine. So I wonder if these investors are looking at it like that, or if it's gotten to the point where it's too cumbersome, that there's too much inventory and they're going, oh, I'm going to lose on this. I don't know if I should
do
it.
Well, dude, that's what I think. I think that's where the problem is and why Florida is such a unique case study. Because, yes, home values are down. So look at Port St. Lucie. Port St. Lucie. Right now, the statistics, the analytics say that it's overvalued by almost 41%. Right? Mm-hmm. The average time on market in Florida and in that area is almost 9.5 months
inventory. Yeah.
9.5 months of inventory, which means it takes almost 10 months, almost a full year, to exhaust the current inventory that is currently on the market, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where the key factor is. Everybody looks at home prices, and on the surface, you go, oh, well, hell, you know what? I want to pick up some properties in Florida because I can get a deal, mm-hmm. right? And I can get a house 20, 30, maybe 35% under list, right?
Mm-hmm.
Potentially 15% under market value.
Especially wholesalers who will take advantage
of it. And for the most part, people will be like, this is a good idea. Let's go ahead and invest in this area. However, the insurance portion of this and mm-hmm. then the property taxes mm-hmm. that Florida has, because remember, there's no income tax in Florida, right? There's no state income tax, but there is property tax, which is elevated. So you start to add the increase in property tax, and then you start to add the inflation when it comes to insurance. I still don't think the numbers work for investors. So any investors that would have in a normal environment gone through and picked up some of that inventory mm-hmm. to keep things off the market to where home prices would continue to stay high, I think goes away because mm-hmm. their numbers won't work.
It's too much of a risk.
Because think about it. Let's mm-hmm. say they do buy a house and they're going to flip it. They still have to pay the insurance on the house. So instead of paying, I don't know, call it $200 a month in insurance, they're now paying $500 a month on insurance. Mm-hmm. Now they can't take as much of it. They have to have a lower price, and there's sellers that are not willing to sell it at the price that investors would need for the numbers to actually work.
Yeah.
So now you take them out of the buying pool, you take normal buyers out of the buying pool, you take people from other states out of the buying pool, and you still have the insurance and the taxes at the same level. I mean, to make it make sense, it may take a 40% drop in home prices in
yeah.
Florida for people to go back there and feel comfortable.
And let's talk about one of the largest, because don't get me wrong, single family homes are a big element, but mm-hmm. as we know, snowbirds, they're looking to downsize. They're looking to
yes.
go down.
Downsize and low maintenance.
And exactly, and low maintenance.
Yes.
So one of the largest areas that they move to is townhomes and condos.
Yep.
And guys, we've seen it here with our natural disasters, with hail and the fires and stuff that we've seen. What HOAs are doing in townhomes and condos, they have to make their money. They have to cover themselves. So they're raising their HOA rates. They're raising their insurance deductibles because single family residence, you just have to cover that residence. If you're in a townhome or a condo, you have to cover every townhome and condo in there. So it's this unique bubble where, yes, the condos and the townhomes are getting cheaper, but when you add in the insurance, when you add in the raise in the HOAs and the insurance premiums with the HOAs, those are not desirable now.
No, and why? So what's the biggest reason that those HOA fees are increasing in Florida specifically?
Because of disasters.
Which disaster?
The hurricane.
No.
No?
Go back, I think it was 2 years ago. They had that condo, I think it was north of Miami, that collapsed.
Oh.
Do you not remember that?
No.
So, okay. So here, let me, you keep talking. I'll pull this up.
Okay. Well, and I mean, that's the thing too with, again, condos and townhomes. I know my grandfather, when right before he passed, he went down.
I know you saw this, dude. Everybody saw this.
And he went down and he bought a townhome specifically because he didn't want to deal with it. And townhomes and condos, again, with the HOA, they take care of those things for you. They'll do the maintenance. You just say, hey, the sidewalk in front of my apartment, in front of my townhome is cracked. They go, okay, that's in our HOA budget. Then they cover it.
Right.
But again, when you have that insurance going up and you have the HOA premiums going up, like you were saying before, the insurance could go up by $400 a month, which if that happens to your HOA, they're not going to take the blunt force of that. I'm sorry. They're going to put it onto you and everybody that lives in it. So everybody's going to go up. They're going to see an increase again in those monthly payments.
So one of the biggest drivers of this HOA increase in Florida was because of June 24th, 2021. Okay. So the city of the town of Surfside had a condo, the Champlain Towers South. Okay. It's 12 story condominium, 136 units. That's how big this was. And there was structural failure in the parking garage underneath the pool. And it collapsed at 2 o'clock in the morning. Killed 98 people.
Damn.
And what ended up happening was they started to dig like they would. The investigators were trying to figure out why this condo would just randomly collapse. And they realized, you know what I'm talking about.
Now I remember.
And they realized there was all these structural things that were being pushed to the side, partly because the HOA didn't want to increase and do what we would call a special assessment, in which case, just for you guys to understand, anytime you buy a townhome or condo that has an HOA, there is something called a special assessment. And a special assessment means they will go in, and in Colorado, the most common form of special assessment has to do with hail. So if there's hail damage on a condo or a townhome, and the condo or townhome has to file an insurance claim, and they have to come out of pocket with their deductible, they will essentially get some of those funds from the tenants. And let's say that, you know, the deductible that they want to pay for is $10,000. They will split that amongst every affected unit within that complex to help cover that cost.
Yep.
The reason they do that is because they would rather do a one-time fee to the homeowners than increase the HOA significantly over the lifetime
and
of the
let us
building,
let us
right?
know in the comments what would you prefer. Would you prefer your HOA protects ahead of time and ups your monthly HOA fees, or would you prefer that they do a special assessment? Because I think I don't know, it's a hard thing, especially in somewhere like Florida. If I know that it's a possibility, I'd rather have that built into my budget monthly to where I know that it's covered.
Well,
versus
it depends, right? Because let's say the special assessment is $10,000 per unit, right? Or the HOA increase is $150 per unit.
Yep.
Well, everybody's going to have a different opinion because some people may only be living there part-time. Some people may only be living there for the next 2 years. If I'm only living there the next 2 years, yeah, I'll take the monthly.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going to live there for 10 to 15 years, I'll take the $10,000. But everybody's got to vote on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complicated scenario. But this specific collapse that killed 98 people, the investigation team went in and realized that there was deferred maintenance on this condo, right? And the deferred maintenance was what caused this collapse, which makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. They're on the coast, there's salt water, and which is extremely corrosive, and so on and so forth, okay? Well, then what happened was everybody else that owned a condo or townhome started yelling at their HOAs, hey, I don't want my building to collapse and kill 98 people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now all the HOAs are forced to go in and disclose that there is all of this deferred maintenance up and down the coast of Florida in these condominiums, and the only way to fix it is special assessments and HOA increases. To that point, the average HOA fee is anywhere from $100 to $350 a month. That is increased now to almost $450 to $600 a month. in the last 3 years.
That's huge. That is a huge uptick. And yep. I know, listeners, it doesn't sound like that, but I mean, on average, you may see...
That's a car payment.
I was going to say, on average, normally, you may see an increase in your HOA every 5 years of $60, $100 every 5 years, but to the fact that it's almost $250 in 3 years...
So how's that affecting inventory?
It's going to cause more inventory.
Why?
Because people don't want to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they're trying to offload the properties.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, again, and that's... I just love the perfect storm that it is where... We're seeing the most home equity in the United States ever in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a market like Florida, I can only imagine how scary that is. Because for the last 3 years, you've been going, oh, shit, look at all this equity I have. Look what I can do. Look what I can do. Your monthly payments are going up. And now you're going, oh, shit, I can't afford this monthly. Right. But I got to get out. Oh, great, I have equity. But you waited too long. And now you're trying to sell your house to get the equity out of it. But you might lose that equity because there's too much inventory and you're going to have to reduce the price.
Yeah, and I think this is a bigger story. I'm of the mindset that I do believe.
I love real estate.
That you are going to see a significant decline in home prices in Florida, mm-hmm. regardless if a majority of it's coming from condos or if it's single family, because like we're based out of Denver, Colorado, right? And right now, we're both working with buyers and sellers. The market's slow,
mm-hmm.
right? Like our projection is we're going to either be flat or potentially have decline in prices.
We're at the highest average days on market since the pandemic.
Correct. And mm-hmm. we have about 3.5 months of inventory mm-hmm. currently in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a historic run up yep. in home prices, right? So our rubber band's getting snapped back. And we have the same issues with insurance for the most part, right? Because we're seeing home insurance premiums. I think it was like 40% in mm-hmm. Colorado is what they increased. Yep. We're at 3.5 months on inventory in Colorado or the Denver metro area, which to us as realtors.
I mean, some areas saw 100%.
Is slow. I'm just saying the market is slow.
Absolutely.
Right. You've gotten deals mm-hmm. for buyers. I've gotten deals for buyers because houses aren't moving. Mm-hmm. So it's slow. 3.5 months on average, right? Nationwide, the average is 3.7, 3.8 months of inventory. In Florida alone, you've got Cape Coral, 12 months, up from 8.6 last year. Miami, 11.4 months.
Is Naples on there?
Up 3 months last year. I want to say Naples is 9 months.
I was going to say, the only reason I bring up Naples is because in the last 3 years, Naples has become one of those sleeper markets.
Yes.
Where you wouldn't expect there to be $2.5, $3 million homes.
Yes.
But a lot of the market is that. And that's because you're having money come from these areas like California, New York, where the home prices did go. They have that equity. They can afford it.
Yes.
And I had a buddy that lived in Naples that was doing real estate, and he moved
mm-hmm.
because of the market. And he moved to Georgia, which doing a phenomenal job now. Congratulations, John. Happy for you, my man. Great foresight that you had with this market. But it's definitely interesting to see how even developers are adjusting. And I mean, even to my point, guys, it's a good time right now to work with a developer because they need to get rid of these homes. And if there's a lot of inventory, they're going to give you deals. So like, look for these new build communities.
So check this out, right? Plot twist. And this is why we say it's hyper local. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you look at Cape Coral, you look at Port St. Lucie, you look at Miami, you look at Marion County in Ocala, you look at Lakeland,
mm-hmm.
you're seeing those home prices drop,
yep.
right? Because they have more inventory than there's demand. And we measure inventory by months of supply, right? Fort Lauderdale is sitting at almost 11 months of supply. For context, a buyer's market is defined as when there's at least 6 months of supply. That's what a buyer's market is, where buyers hold the power. They can negotiate down, get concessions, et cetera, et cetera. And in buyer's markets, 99 out of 100 times, it means that home prices are declining.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Lauderdale went from 8 months of inventory to 11 months of inventory year over year. What do you think the home prices did in Fort Lauderdale?
They went up by 1%.
They went up by 27% year over year.
Holy shit.
What? With 11 months of inventory,
that's
the
crazy.
Average home price in Fort Lauderdale is $642,000. 27% higher than what it was last year, even though their months of inventory went up. by 3 months.
And I'll say it, we've said it before, I'll say it again. If anybody tells you they know what's going to happen in the real estate market, they're lying
that is
to you.
But that's the embodiment, right? Like, yeah. We're looking at all these things. Okay, as inventory, months of inventory increase, prices decrease. But in certain areas where there's an influx in capital, like Fort Lauderdale, just north of Miami, you're talking the inventory went up, but home prices went up 27%.
Money's a crazy thing.
You know what I'm saying? Like that's when we talk about hyperlocal. That is the embodiment of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Is you don't know. Mm-hmm. And anybody that goes, oh, I'm gonna look at blah, 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 blah. Yeah, directionally you could be accurate, but it depends on the area. To bring it to Colorado, it's the exact same thing. Yep. Right? If you look at average home prices and months of inventory in Castle Rock, Colorado versus Parker, you have a buyer's market in Castle Rock. You have a seller's market in Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the months of inventory are about the same, people have so much flexibility on where they can move.
Mm-hmm.
It has completely disrupted the normal statistics that we look at to determine where you can and can't get a deal.
100%. 100%. We say it all the time, guys. Whether you're working with us or another agent, this is why it's so important that you reach out and you look. And guys, I'll be real with you. I know, we're on social media. Obviously, we utilize social media to get information and clips out to you guys. But we have a very unique opportunity in our day and age where if you go on social media and you type in Florida real estate agent, let's just say in the search bar on Instagram, the algorithm will push you Florida real estate content. And guys, if you have an agent that is constantly putting out content, that has a bunch of videos on there that's showing you market updates, talk to that agent. I guarantee you that agent would be more than happy to say, oh yeah, this is my review of Fort Lauderdale. This is my review of Naples, whatever it may be. But we haven't had this opportunity before.
No.
As a society to hyper-focus on somebody. You can even type in Fort Lauderdale, Florida real estate agent. Find them, shoot them a DM and be like, hey man, I'm hearing some stuff's going down. Is this a good time? And they will tell you.
Yep.
Like, please utilize your resources. Don't just rely on Zillow and these news articles that you see with Redfin. Reach out.
Can I go on a tangent?
Yeah.
It's a small tangent, but it's adjacent, right? Mm-hmm. So I saw something interesting where last year, nationwide, 71% of realtors sold one
or zero.
Or zero homes,
mm-hmm.
okay? Which means that you have almost a 75% chance. If you just reach out on Zillow or anywhere else to a random realtor, there is a 71% chance that that person did not sell a house last year. And this is a business of practice. And you can have practice one of two ways. You can be constantly talking about the market and you can be immersed in market statistics and so on and so forth, like we are when we do these podcasts. Like we dive into the analytics, mm-hmm. we dive into the statistics, we look at different markets, because we want to give you guys the best information possible, right? Or you can have somebody that is selling homes in the market and is active because they're working with buyers and working with sellers. But if you just randomly reach out to somebody, there's a 71% chance that in the last 12 months, they haven't sold anything. And if they haven't sold anything and they're not constantly trying to better themselves from a market standpoint, the chances of you working with somebody that has no fucking idea what they're doing is 71%.
And guys, pull the veil back on the industry, right? These agents that you see on Zillow, these agents that you see on Realtor.com, whatever. Pay to play. Like, please, please, please know that. And I'm going to say, I am one of those agents that did one deal last year.
Mm-hmm.
But I guarantee you, I've had conversations with agents that did 10, and they are so disconnected.
Yes,
because they're paying for your phone number, they're paying for access to your email. Then their TC, who sits in an office all day, is reaching out and calling you and establishing it. They're putting their name on the contract and they're paying for it. Just because Zillow, Redfin, Realtor.com push these agents to you does not mean that they are an agent that is top tier, that they are the best agent. It simply means that they paid money to be on a zip code and get their name pushed to you. Now, not every agent that does that is a bad agent. I need to let you guys know, because I think the statistic was something like 85% of real estate information by consumers is taken in by websites like Zillow, Redfin, all of these websites. And just please, guys, just from somebody who is adjacent to the industry, in the industry, I do all marketing for it. I just closed a transaction with first-time home buyers. Not every agent that you see online is a good agent just because they're being pushed by a platform. That's all I'm going to say.
Here's what else I will say. I still believe market fundamentals will win out over the long run.
Yeah.
Right? So even a place like Fort Lauderdale, we just said, inventory has increased 3 months, which means people are not buying as often. However, you've got an increase in home prices at 27%. If you dive deeper, right? And I think if I were to look, and I haven't yet, but if I look at like a city or a neighborhood like Brickell in Miami, I think it would be the same story. It's skewed because when you have a financial hub or a tech hub in a city, there's a lot of new construction that's happening. And that new construction is so above and beyond the normal home values that you see that it only takes half of those to sell to make up for the difference of the homes that are not selling. And at the end of the day, if an area is overvalued and nothing else changes, and when I say nothing else, I mean the three pillars of affordability, wage growth, interest rates, home prices. If that doesn't change, eventually the dam will break. It will. It just will. I believe that in 2 years, you're not going to see Fort Lauderdale continuing to grow home valuations at 27% year over year. You're just not. Right now, yes, there's a lot of new construction, new condos, and the average selling price of those condos may be $1.5 million, where the average home price is $625,000, which means if I sell two condos for every one house that doesn't sell, I'm making up that gap, right? Mm-hmm. But it will catch up because at the end of the day, the average homeowner is working on an average wage that can afford an average price. And eventually that skewed balance will correct itself in home prices. You just have to be patient, right?
Yep. Yeah.
But you got to know where to look. Port St. Lucie, if you're looking at retiring there and you're going, oh my God, you guys are 41% overvalued. If I'm a buyer, I go to my agent and I say, hey, just out of curiosity, what if we offered 40% under list in that area because the fundamentals make sense? Try it.
Yep.
Maybe you get it 30% under list, but you know what? It makes up for the increase in insurance, and they've got a house that's 30% off, and you save $200 a month. Like, those are the things, and when we say that it's hyper-local, we're talking Port St. Lucie versus Tampa, which are very close to each other, very, very different markets, very different demographics. Make sure that you guys are doing that research, and this is why we wanted to pick Florida, because if you look nationwide and what everybody's saying, well, home prices are going to increase here and, you know, we'll see interest rates drop a little bit. But then you start looking at specific areas, you go, there's pockets and there's places that you wouldn't normally think that are actually on the precipice of losing a ton of value and becoming great bargains. Mm-hmm. You got to look and you got to talk to people in those areas to see what they're seeing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis.
Mm-hmm. No, and I honestly, this is a great conversation. I love doing deep dives on markets like this.
Dude, it's great.
But again, this is why I love real estate. It's because no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing in real estate, if you know the basis information, then you can gauge a market. You can understand it. You can reach out. You can ask the right questions. And again, guys, this is exactly why we do this podcast. And I think this is a great time to move into the One Rock takeaway for today's episode. I'll go ahead and start it off. My One Rock takeaway for today's episode is... lean on specialists and reach out to people who understand. I always go back to Ford on the stand when he was getting grilled by his company and they were trying to take it from him. And he says, look, I don't need to know everything. I have a phone number. I have a phone on my desk and I can call and get to the expert on any topic at any point in time. Guys, we live in a time where you have access to those experts more so than you ever have before. And most of them would be free to talk to you. They'd be happy to talk to you. Just as an example, we have people all the time that we say, oh, we're on a podcast. And they go, oh my God, you have a podcast? And it's like, yeah, we do a weekly podcast.
With a guitar.
We do a weekly podcast where we talk about bourbon, but that in their minds, when we say we have a podcast, we got 100,000 followers. We're the biggest. We're, you know, Dave Ramsey, whoever it is. And it's like, no, but we do this weekly because we want to stay on top of things. So reach out to that person on social media that's on Instagram or TikTok that you value, you like their content. Reach out to them, ask them questions, because I promise you they are proud of the content that they're creating and they are proud to be able to provide you that information. That's my One Rock takeaway.
So my One Rock takeaway builds on the idea that real estate's local, right? And you have experts, okay? But I'm going to take it a step further. When you guys are talking to people and you're looking at buying, selling, investing in real estate, I believe, and it's just because it's what I've been told, you can pretty quickly sniff out those individuals that are passionate about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speaking for myself and I'm speaking for Charlie. We are passionate about what we do, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't drag myself on one foot every week on crutches to come do this podcast. But I think it's extremely important to let people know what's happening in the real estate market.
I called my grandma because I got my buyers $12,000 in concessions and $25,000 off purchase price. I take pride in the fact that I can help people with the single biggest purchase of their own. Like,
but you can tell, right? Like, if mm-hmm. I've talked to somebody, and I've talked to other realtors, that you talk to them and you're like, you know what? Like, you're doing it as a job, but you're not passionate about it. Understand that there are certain people that are good at their job because they're good at their job, and there's other people that are good at their job and passionate about their job. Work with those individuals mm-hmm. and learn how to figure out who they are. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, like, I'm in charge of, like, the posting on Instagram and TikTok and whatnot. Charlie's in charge of the content itself. We wouldn't be doing this if we weren't passionate about it. And our passion has led us to continually learn and grow in real estate. And if you can find those people in whatever area you're looking at purchasing, whether it's fucking Toledo or Miami or Buffalo, New York, or Denver, Colorado, work with those individuals because those are the ones that are going to be doing deep dives, doing research, solving problems preemptively, going above and beyond answering the phones. Like, there's a lot of stuff that goes mm-hmm. into it. And this industry is so
saturated.
I don't want to say problematic and saturated, but like, we have just recently, right? Just if you look at both of our most recent transactions, the amount of hurdles that had to be overcome to make them go from under contract to closing, I would tell you 95% of realtors, and again, Colorado's got 51,000 licensed, right? 95% of them would have flubbed it and fumbled at the 1 yard line. But we're passionate. We're in a constant growth mindset. We want to make sure we know what we need to do. Understand who those people are when you're choosing to work with somebody. And you guys will have a phenomenal experience. But I think it's very important.
Absolutely. Yep. And on the flip side of that, not only are we passionate about real estate, we are passionate about bourbon and whiskey. And I think this now we can move into the bourbon review for today's episode.
Remind the people, how does it work?
So the rock rating that we do is on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the best, 10 being the worst, because the more rocks or ice cubes you put in a bourbon, usually the worse that bourbon is, and you're trying to water it down to be able to taste it. Jameson, I know you went for a second pour.
I did.
I just want to say, just straight out, the bourbon that we're drinking, 3-Chord, Strange Edition. Again, guys, please remember that this is a cask barrel pick, a staff pick. You see it on the top of the bottle. Normally, this bottle is 99 proof.
Mm-hmm.
The barrel that Pinnistry got is 120.
112.
Yeah. And the burn is not there. It's got a good bourbon burn, but it's not one. As somebody who drinks bourbon, I guess if you don't drink 112 proofs normally, it might kill you. But as the flavor comes through, and we always talk about the definition of a good bourbon,
mm-hmm.
it's complexity. And I always bring it up because the bartenders here always like remind us, like, hey, most people aren't sipping on their stuff for an hour, right? They're not dogging sipping on it. But I think personally, if it holds up to that hour,
yeah,
then it is a phenomenal mash bill down to the chemistry of the structure of the bourbon. And I'll tell you what, if you guys remember at the beginning of the episode, we talked about the tasting notes and the flavor notes, and it said clove. And I did not get it.
It's coming through now, though.
My goodness gracious. That is the prominent flavor that I'm getting on the back end of my palate.
So this is, oh man, I'm going to expose myself a little bit.
I want to take JC's glass.
When you were a kid, okay? Did you, and you grew up East Coast.
Yep.
I grew up East Coast for a little bit. The grass is different on the East Coast.
Yes.
There's just more water, better mm-hmm. soil, whatever, right? Used to go to my backyard and I would like pick the grass, mm-hmm. okay? This is going to be, if anybody else has this memory, please let me know, okay? But I would, when it was long, before my mom would cut it, I would pick a blade of grass. And the, obviously on the top is very green. Then you get down to the root, and the root is very white.
Yes.
Right? I would chew on the root of that Kentucky bluegrass.
Yep.
Because it was so, I don't know, like flavorful.
I'm sorry if you guys are, I just took a sip, a sniff.
My point is this. The clove has come through.
Yeah.
And to me, it's akin to me chewing on a grass blade that has that really like moist bottom third of the grass blade where it just tastes fresh.
Clean.
I don't know how to explain it.
No, I
did
know
you
exactly.
do that though? Like, did you chew on grass? Because obviously the top is like, man, it's just grass, right? But you get to that root where it's white, it turns white, and it's very, like, it's just filled with water.
Yep.
And it's, oh my God. Yep. I don't know. But that's what I get out of this.
Yes. Well, hold on. And so I picked, if you guys don't know, if you have aren't long listeners, JC, all three of our friends, he's the one that got us started on this. And we always leave a glass for him. We pour it and it stays open. Dude, the nose, how are you, how? It sat for...
It's still that
55.
It's still
not only that, but it still has the ethanol.
It does have the ethanol.
And if you guys don't see these glasses, these are wide berths. Like the diameter of the top of this, it should not have that. It should have aerated out by now, but it still has that ethanol to it. Yep. And you take a taste, that clove comes through, and I think I'm solidifying like what I said at the beginning of dessert bourbon. That this right here. If I had a good steak dinner, like a good hearty dinner with steak, some asparagus, some potatoes, and then I was like, you know what, I want to relax with some friends and have a drink by the fire, this right here, the way that even sitting open with a wide, the clove opened up, the sweetness is still there, but it's not overpowering, and then the oak, the wood, 100% comes through.
It maintains the initial character that we thought.
And it adds to it.
But it adds that clove.
The literal definition of opening and complexity.
It adds a clove because as some of that sweetness is burned off, right? The sweetness burned off. The actual ethanol did not.
Yes.
And I think that's because it's a high proof. But it allowed the clove to come through. And when you've got, again, when I think of clove, and I go back to Oscar the one time, I forget what bourbon it was, but he kept saying like fresh cut grass.
Yeah.
It's crisp.
Yes.
I guess
it's clean.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it's crisp. It's something that it hits the palate and you go, that's a little different.
Yeah.
It's a little different. It still has the caramel notes, the black fruit with the plum, like the dark plum, the grape.
Yep.
I get the Pinot Noir.
But then the Pinot actually pulls the moisture. Like it's, you get that wine dryness from the tannins of it. That, man. Chris, thank you. As always, man, thank you so much.
I do think it's tough because I feel like we have to...
I want to do it against the normal one.
Right. You have to have a separate category for the bourbons that are aged in non-bourbon casks.
Yes.
Right? Same thing when we did the Noble collaboration with High West. It was such a unique bourbon, and we rated it so high.
Yeah.
But because it was so different. So I'd love to do... a tasting with like this aged in a Pinot Noir, the High West aged in agave barrels. We had the Balcones aged in the 100-year-old champagne barrels. Like, I feel like that needs to be its own category.
It does because it's funny because
compare this flavor. Like what, for me, right? I like this. This is reminiscent of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
Right. It just is, but it's also at the same time completely different.
Yeah.
So like you can't, I wouldn't put Midsummer Night's Dram against this.
No.
Because Midsummer Night's Dram is not aged in Pinot Noir barrels.
Well, and not only that, it's just with, I'll be honest with you guys, and you've heard me talk about it often, is a lot of these I think are shtick bourbons. Like let's put that it's aged in a certain barrel and then we'll throw another $50 on the price. The last couple of ones that we've had actually hold up. It's not it's not a scam. It's not a gimmick where it feels like they put flavor into it or they're trying to do something that's not there. This takes on the flavor notes that you expect it to from a Pinot. And
it complements it.
Exactly. And but it complements it. It's not overpowering. It doesn't destroy one element. It all rolls into it together. And I mean, you guys know I do the one pour in mine compared to JC's. Mine's sweeter, but again, I'm swirling it around. I'm tasting it. I'm opening it. JC's just sits. But
yeah, naturally opens.
Yes, right. And mine still has the burn. It still has the wood flavors from it. But now all I'm getting at the back end is just that it's literally almost like an explosion of clove.
Yes.
That adds to the dryness of the Pinot and the wine. And I think that is phenomenal. I don't know how to rate it. So especially because this is, and again, I think what we need to almost do is almost have the barrel pick and the normal and the regular side by side, because I don't know if you were to go out and buy this bottle, the special, the strange collaboration, you're looking at about $56 to $62 market. And that's 99 proof. I don't know how different this is, because I would pay extra for this.
Yeah.
If I came in and they're like, this is what the notes are supposed to be, this is what it does over time, I would pay the extra just to have this version of the strange collaboration, because I do think that it evolves in a way that the normal wouldn't. And the fact that it's 112 proof, not 99, adds to it for me.
Yeah, I'd probably pay $90 for this bottle.
Yeah. Yeah, 85, $90, 100%, especially if you have an event going on. Like I said, I have buddies coming up, like I did for Christmas with the Old Soul bottle. This is exactly what I would do. Mm-hmm. But I can't sit here and say, hey, guys, yeah, go do this, because I haven't had the regular. This is the barrel choice. This is Chris's palate saying this is a good bourbon. He hasn't missed, man. One time. Chris has not missed.
No, his barrel picks are...
Yeah, phenomenal. Phenomenal. But on that note, guys, thank you so much for tuning in.
Wait, hold on. What'd you rate it?
I don't want to, because I feel like it's so,
you gotta rate it.
I gotta rate it. All right. If okay.
On that note, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just leaving it.
I'll just leave it.
As a normal bourbon, if I were to put
remember,
it up against,
remember, it came with
a
guitar.
It did come with a guitar. If I were to rate this against, like, you know, what we say is a standard bourbon, a high proof, I'd probably rate it a little higher. Probably about a 2.93, only because of the sweetness. That if you were to take this and put it against something that is more of what we call a standard bourbon flavor, yeah, I think it would be too sweet. But in the category that it's in, where it's aged in a Pinot Noir barrel, the price and the cost that it is, I would have to give it a 2.2, 2.3. Because I love the complexity, I love the evolution over time, the proofing. You can act like, and I'll tell you guys, you know, obviously drink responsibly, but the feeling that I'm getting from it, like bodily, let's talk about, you know, when you drink alcohol, obviously you're going to feel a different kind of way. I feel more relaxed than I do buzzed.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a whole body. It's sitting at the base of my neck, and I feel more relaxed than I do like, oh, I'm ready to party. And for me, that's why I think, again, like I said, this is a phenomenal dessert bourbon. So if I'm categorizing it and I'm rating it on what it is, where it sits in the Pinot Noir barrel, I'm going to put it at 2.2, 2.3. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to go like a solid 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's holding me back is the pour amount,
yeah,
which is $35 a pour.
Yep.
That is tough for me to swallow, right? Mm-hmm. And again, insider information, I know what this bottle costs.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pour is half the cost of the full bottle...
But that's where I say it's hard, because I don't know what this barrel pick is.
It's a little elevated.
I don't know what this barrel pick is in comparison to the
normal. But even if it's $90, let's say, right? Because I think you said retail is 60.
Yeah.
So let's say it's 90, right? It's a third. That's a tough pill to swallow. But if I can get this at $80 personally, and I'm not drinking it at a bar, that 2.5, I think it's a great bourbon.
Oh, and don't forget, guys. One thing that the Rouge does, you can come in here and buy a bottle.
Correct, yes.
So if you don't want to pay for the pour, talk to Chris. You can get a bottle and leave with a bottle.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go 2.5.
Yeah.
I love it. I think the sweetness is not going to be for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But the balance that it has and the longevity it has over the last hour, keeping not only the flavor, but the essence of a cask strength bourbon,
Yep.
2.5.
I love it. Yep, I love it. And guys, as always, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us at any point in time, Jameson, Oscar, or I. You can find Oscar at Oscar the Realtor. You can find myself at Charlie Sardelli.
Find me, the Colorado Real Estate Guy.
And if you want to, please subscribe, like, follow the channel, reach out to us on there, send us a DM, follow our Instagram page. We just started it, Mile High Perspective. It shows up as Colorado Real Estate. But you can always get in touch with us. Send us an email any point in time, resotr@themilehighperspective.com, or give us a phone call.
720-584-3361.
And we love all the questions that are coming in, guys. Thank you so much for sending us the request to be on the podcast, the request to have a bourbon. We appreciate it more than you know. Like we've been saying, 2025 is going to be a big year. We're going to try and bump it up for you guys. We have some bourbon collaborations that we're working on the back end. But with that being said, come check out the Rouge, guys. This Irish flight that they're doing for the next month is a phenomenal value. If you love Irish whiskey, you want to just try something different, $55 to $58 for 2 ounce pours for those three. It's the green, the yellow, and the gold. Green spot, yellow spot, gold spot. Come out, give it a try. Every single bartender here knows what they're talking about. They know bourbon, they know wine. They will describe it to you, they'll break it down for you, and you'll enjoy the experience, no doubt. So thank you guys so much. We'll catch you on next week's episode. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Real Estate Served on the Rocks. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and really anywhere that you listen to podcasts. For the video version, subscribe to our YouTube channel at Living in Colorado, The Mile High Perspective. And to stay up to date with all the events going on at the Rouge Wine and Bourbon Bistro, visit their website, therougewinebar.com.